Грандиозный скандал. Публикация расследования...
Заглавленные панамские документы...
Панамской офшорной юридической компании Mossack Fonseca.
Миллиарды долларов тщательно спрятаны от
в центре внимания виолончелист Сергей Ралдугин был таким фронтменом президента России.
Нам нужна целая система мер по деофшоризации нашей экономики.
It was the biggest journalistic leak in history. It documented the offshore dealings of officials around the world, and its reverberations are being felt from Iceland to China. But while the Panama Papers have taught us a lot about how the rich and powerful hide their money from tax collectors and have already claimed the scalp of Iceland's prime minister, in Russia, they showed us something else entirely. They've given us a glimpse of how Vladimir Putin's regime plunders and launders state assets. They've highlighted the difference between corruption in the West, where it's a bug in the software, and in Russia, where it isn't a bug, it isn't even a feature. No, in Russia, corruption is the software. It's the country's operating system. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security service, and an author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. Glad you're free from the hell otherwise known as Moscow traffic.
Just about made it.
Just made it. Glad to have you. Also joining us via Skype from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Habegger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Welcome back, Karen.
Nice to talk to you, Brian.
Always nice to talk to you. And Karen, let's start with you. I mean, the Russia-related materials in the Panama Papers, to me at least, felt almost like a continuation of or a sequel to your book. What new insights have we gained as a result of this week's bombshell?
Well, we see how it works. Before, we could say that the money clearly went missing from the state budget, that there was a big gap between what Gazprom was getting, let's say, for its gas and what the profits that it was declaring. But now we see the entire circle of how money was taken offshore, into what accounts it went, what kind of companies were set up, and what people did with those companies. And while we see the names of some familiar people around Putin, we also see the involvement of state banks. We see state actions. So it's not just about whether this nice cellist was buying musical instruments abroad.
You can buy a lot of nice musical instruments with that money.
More of that later, I'm sure. But it's about how the Russian state entities, Russian state banks, made all of this happen and structured the interactions.
So we see the whole web of we don't see the whole web, because I think what we saw this week was a fraction of what's actually out there. I mean, $2 billion is just the tip of the iceberg, right?
Look, let's set this up. Panama ranks, and that means Mossack Fonseca and its 30-odd branches abroad, ranks only number 13 of all the countries that have offshore accounts in terms of the number of accounts. It's a small player. And here we have revelations from one company in one jurisdiction. So, and if we're talking about Russia, and of course we are, Panama is not the number one place that Russian money goes. Switzerland is the number one place Russian money goes. And we even saw a Swiss footprint in the accounts for Ralduggen. So we're far more likely to be talking about large number of Russian high-level people if someone in Switzerland does the same thing that someone
right.
in Mossack Fonseca did, or did to Mossack Fonseca.
So this week we just saw a fraction of the total in the dollar amount, but we're going to see that the schemes are going to look pretty much the same as
right.
more probably comes out, as I expect that it will. Mark, you had a piece in Vox this week in which you argued that the Panama Papers really shows us how corruption works in Russia. For those of you who missed Mark's piece, and shame on you, Mark, why don't you enlighten us and show us how what is this? What did this show you?
Well, I think my essential thesis was that while we obviously see money being secreted away, actually the key currency in Russia is power rather than money. And in some ways, money is the symptom of where that power lies. Someone like Putin, and obviously, you know, clearly this money is going to be connected to Putin. We're not quite sure exactly sort of to what level and how directly it's him particularly, or a group of people around him or close to him or whatever. But nonetheless, I mean, the way he accumulates money is not just simply in the sort of classic banana republic sense of looting the state treasury. It's as much as anything else, probably actually just people giving him money as tribute, just as they might well give him, for example, a yacht or a large palace. And that is the way in which they actually buy themselves into his favor, and he in turn then rewards them with contracts, opportunities to embezzle and make far more money themselves. So when it comes down to it, I mean, I think the crucial issue for me is, yes, of course, it's interesting to see this. I mean, we've now learnt detail about a system that, in a way, in essence, we all knew about. And certainly no one in Moscow is actually expressing any great surprise about the underlying trajectory of this story. But to me, the key thing is exactly that, in fact, the corruption in Russia should not be just purely measured in dollar amounts. It's where that money comes from, which is from power. How do you get to keep it, which is by your relationship to power. And why is it distributed? Because you have flattered or are otherwise useful to power.
Mm-hmm. Do you attach any significance to something a lot of Kremlin apologists are making a lot of hay about, that Putin's name doesn't appear in any of this?
Well, I mean, I would personally, and I think, you know, this is an interesting area for discussion. I mean, my view is that Putin, first and foremost, is not actually about the money these days. If nothing else, because within Russia, he can get anything he wants through the state, or basically getting an oligarch to stump it up or whatever. You salt money away primarily because you're thinking of a future in which you may not be in your current position. I think there's little evidence to suggest that Putin is really thinking in those terms. It was different in the 1990s.
He's not planning for a quiet retirement?
It's funny that, actually. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'm just sure he's just planning a sort of a nice sort of, you know, quiet little one, you know, an unostentatious one, perhaps with a little homestead somewhere in Kamchatka. But, when it comes down to it, I think that actually, and you'll like this because it plays to your mafia state meme, this is, as much as anything else, in my opinion, an obshchak, a kind of common fund that a lot of powerful people maintain, into which he can dip. Of course, because he can reach anything he wants, but not necessarily just simply, this is not just simply, I would say, Putin's money.
Yeah, no, I thought Leonid Bershitsky put it really well in his column in Bloomberg this week, where he said that Putin, the name, may have not been on any of the documents, but Putin, the institution, was all over all of them.
The collective Putin.
The collective Putin, exactly.
The collective Putin is very much hit by Panama Papers. And I would say that Putin family is very much hit by the Panama Papers. I mean, Kirill Chmyalov's name is all over the Panama Papers, in the sense that, you know, just the Roldugin, the cellist, was also the godfather. Some of the money from Sandalwood that was set up with Roldugin money was then found its way to firms owned by Chmyalov. And so you have a godfather of a Putin child, a son-in-law of a Putin child. I think we can say Putin personally is tulips of the Panama Papers, but the collective Putin clearly is what's most interesting. Look, Brian, when you say it reads like a sequel to my book, there's nothing in my book that shows that Putin signed anything from which he benefited. Nothing. Mm-hmm. So this system, and I agree very much with the idea that it's obshchak, but it's not even necessary to see it in mafia terms. Ozero Dacha was established with a bank account into which every one of the members could both put in money and withdraw. And it was done under Gorbachev era laws. You know, to give us greater cooperatives. Yeah. That was the economic reform of Gorbachev. Why did why did Putin and his buddies use it? They didn't need to. They could have privatized. Yeah. And I think that's look, it's beneath Putin to have his name on any such document. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to.
That's what underbosses and consigliaries are for.
Yes, exactly. They're the ones who are on the hook. I mean, look what Putin did to Roldugin this week. I mean, say he's a businessman and everybody knows it, and all of our creative intelligentsia are doing the same. I mean, what an insult! And then you say he's one of your friends. I mean, my God, I couldn't believe it.
And he's importing musical instruments. I saw a pretty funny thing on social media this week. I think you probably all saw it. The four wealthiest musicians in the world are Paul McCartney, Mick Jagger, Bono, and Roldugin. anyway, Mark, anything to add here?
Yeah, I mean, I think still when we sort of try and nail down the Putin dimension to this. I mean, I think we need to be cautious. It's not just simply a case of the Godfather working through the deniable and sacrificable cutouts, which is a kind of the mafia model of the underbosses and so forth. I think it is genuinely that this is... I mean, I really don't believe that Putin himself is that... It sounds ridiculous to talk about $2 billion, that interested in this in and of itself. He has transcended money. In the respect, it's what the money represents. The money that he accumulates is because people basically pay him obeisance. This is how you show loyalty to the boss, or one of the ways in which you show loyalty to the boss. And you know, you include him or people close to him or accounts that might be connected to him. You move money in their direction, and that is about power as much as it is about money, or probably more than it is rather about money, I would say.
Hmm.
No, well, ahead, and also we saw in looking at what Roldugin was doing with Kamaz that one of his obligations that he signed up for in becoming a minority shareholder in Kamaz was to make sure that state funds are directed in the direction of Kamaz. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is an obligation, I would say, a bit like going on the board of Guggenheim, that if you're given prestige or access to a board membership, that you have to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you're delivering not only to Putin, you're also delivering to the company that you are going to be on the board of. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that different in that sense. Some of the things that we see represented in Panama Papers show a very multi-structured set of understandings. But when you say he's above money, you know, I think if Putin had just been a slightly different personality, we might not have had such a tendency toward money being at the center of and corruption being at the center of everything that Russia does economically. I mean, I do think that he is very motivated by the accumulation of wealth, which he sees as the most significant indicator of power.
Hmm.
I mean, clearly there are people around him who have different motivations, but I think for Putin it's very significant. And I go back again to this idea of how these companies got set up and how they got filled with money. I mean, Mossack Fonseca, anyone in Russia or anyone anywhere could have set up an account with Mossack Fonseca, obviously. But what Russia added was Mossack Fonseca created the coffee cup I'm holding in my hand right now. But it was the Russian state bank subsidiary in Cyprus, RCB Cyprus, that filled that cup with unsecured loans from the Russian state and then forgave loans. I mean,
and don't forget here, we're talking about Bank Rossiya, a bank that was formed by Putin's cronies.
Well, Bank Rossiya comes into it mainly because of Roldugin being a 3% shareholder in Bank Rossiya. He then takes that position, goes to Switzerland, signs off with Swiss lawyers an affidavit saying he's not a politically exposed person, nor is he connected to one, which is, of course, not true. Then he sets up his account in Mossack Fonseca with the Swiss papers, talking about his incorruptibility, but only then he then gets state funds from RCB Cyprus. This is where most of the money is coming from state money. And then he gets armed with those loan deals. He sets up Sandalwood and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. So to me, the most important part of this is not that, you know, a poor or a rich cellist is, his reputation is hurt. The most important part is that who authorized the opening of RCB Cyprus to pour money into an offshore vehicle with nominee directors that did not include, the directors did not include Roldugin.
Right.
So why would that hose be turned on to fill that coffee cup
if
they didn't know? So, you know, we're talking here about, I mean, Roldugin didn't have the authority to open up RCB Cyprus. So who did?
Right. Well, I think there's only one man who has that.
I mean, there's no real question about the how it happens. And let's be honest, I mean, you think we have similar... I mean, one thing that the papers have shown is actually similar schemes being used across post-Soviet Eurasia. Mm-hmm. But again, I mean, I think I would want to push back on this whole issue of the motivating factor, because the thing is that maybe once upon a time, Putin was indeed motivated by money. Though one has to say, well, what does he actually have to spend that money on? But the thing is, his current set of policies actually are very much, I would say, antithetical to the simply accumulation of money. Terms one and two, fair enough. But now that we have this much more aggressive, one could almost call it neo-imperialistic, policy being adopted by the Kremlin, much more antagonistic with the West. First of all, it's hitting the economy, which also hits the opportunities for this kind of embezzlement. Secondly, it actually makes it harder for him to, or those close to him, to be able to access, move, and enjoy that money. I mean, you know, these kind of assets are far more vulnerable now than they have ever been. So when it comes down to it, I mean, I think, you know, whatever one may say about, as it were, past incarnations Putin. Mm-hmm. Putin at the moment, I think, is about power, it's about historical legacy, it's about his vision for a Russia and his place in the history books, rather than just simply accumulating another $100 billion or $10 billion or whatever it is that he's never going to be able to touch anyway.
Well, so now, first and foremost, we're talking about the maintenance of power, in your opinion, Mark, I would argue. Karen, you wanted to jump in there?
Well, I would only say that while I certainly agree that Putin is now much more about projecting a great power image and aggressiveness in foreign policy and, of course, as we'll talk about later, the creation of a National Guard and so forth, he is taking care of business. I mean, the enrichment of his son-in-law, not only as revealed in this scheme, but in previous schemes related to Sibor. I mean, this is someone who is, Kirill Shemalov is somebody who's the same age as my son, early 30s. He certainly is not yet fit for prime time, but it doesn't matter. So Putin is in fact doing what all the other Siloviki fathers are doing. They are guaranteeing that their sons, mainly the sons, will have good positions and will inherit. Mm. Or not even inherit, because they don't even trust inheritance, will now be given enough money to be independently wealthy.
Mm. Mark,
and if he were only interested in great power, I think he wouldn't make such mistakes. That's a big mistake.
I think Kara makes a good point here, Mark. I mean, part of it is taking care of your own, taking care of your family, taking care of your offspring. In Putin's case, his daughters via his son-in-law.
Sure. But again, I mean, in some ways, look, we can hardly be surprised. That's what happens in every single kleptocracy. That is not a specifically Russian characteristic. Sure, not only kleptocracies, alas. But the point is, in the Russian context, I mean, this is also exactly how he maintains control over the system. Without control, he can do nothing. Therefore, that is, as it were, a necessary prerequisite. But the point is, whether or not it's driven, if he himself is driven by the money or the use of money as an instrument and as a reflection of power. Now, my view is exactly, it's about the power. The people whom he is essentially buying into his entourage and into supporting the system, they may well exactly be interested in money for themselves and palaces and pagodas and great opportunities for their kids. But that's not necessarily the way Putin is operating.
I wanted to go ahead, Karen. There's something.
Let me then ask, if that's true, and it's, you know, presents a kind of very realistic view of what Putin is doing, why do we have so much evidence via Kolesnikov that precedes Panama Papers about Putin's personal obsession with Prayekt Yug, the palace in Gelenjik? I mean, he, according to Kolesnikov, would personally intervene with Kolesnikov to ask him how the project is going. And that was a direct redirection of state health budget funds for a palace that is the size of Versailles.
But you said it yourself. It's state fund. It's not that actually he reached into his bank accounts and bought himself a palace. Of course, he enjoys the good life. He enjoys having a palace. But the thing is, when he wants these things, he uses his political power to simply divert funds. You know, it's not actually as if any of this comes out of his own bank account. So he has much less real reason to have a great and abiding concern with building up that bank account. All of Russia is his bank account. Not just the money been salted out in Panama or whatever, but every single oligarch's fortunes, every single state budget line.
Every kopeck in Russia.
Exactly, is his. When you've got that, then in a way, I think actually, this is why I say, I mean, he transcends money, not because he's some kind of ascetic who lives a sort of a hard scrabble life, but because he's actually reached that point where sort of he doesn't need money, because people will rush forward to provide him whatever he wants, or he can just simply reach out and collect that.
But he says he's a humble servant and he works like a galley slave every day. I mean, what do you mean he's not aesthetic?
Yeah, just think of the galley he must have built.
Must have one hell of a galley. One thing I wanted to touch on here, and Mark, you hit on it a little bit, of the uniqueness of all this. Because I've made this point, I make this point ad nauseum. People are probably sick of hearing me say it. I said it on the Daily Vertical today. I said it in my intro. What this shows is, like, while in the West, corruption's a bug in the software, in Russia, it's not even a feature. It's the software. It's the operating system, right? And this, I mean, the Panama Papers seem to confirm this favorite talking point of mine to the degree that went to the extent that I could see. Western officials appear to be hiding otherwise legitimately earned incomes of their families, is what it looked like, or stuff they earned before coming into office. There was no evidence of plundering state budgets that I saw in the Western cases from the taxman, basically. Where in Russia, it was something else. It was this elaborate scheme of shell companies and offshore havens to plunder and launder state funds. This being the idea that it's part of the software. It is the software. How unique is this? You're both experts on corruption. How unique is this scheme that we see here in Russia?
I think we saw it with Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a lot of those papers, and we see that it was definitely a system based on tribute and loyalty and silence. So the kind of key features of the Putin regime have certainly been present in other autocracies. I think Khodorkovsky was right when he said all authoritarian regimes are kleptocracies.
Mm-hmm.
They have to extract capital from societies that would otherwise resist, so they become increasingly repressive. It's what drives the system from the very beginning. The Putin regime is filled with people who both believe in a strong state, let's call it that way. They believe that democracy is for someone else and certainly not for them, but they all also believe in privatization. They are all Pinochets. So you don't really find in the Kremlin elite people who would stand up and say that we need to stop this because we should have more state control. We should go back to that aspect of the Soviet Union. I mean, there are those people, but they're mainly in the Communist Party. And, you know, that's the big argument that has consumed Russia for the last 25 years, whether to allow the communists to actually come to power, having won elections,
right,
which were which were, you know, those victories were taken away from them. So, and the reason that they are not allowed to take power is because people in the elite want to take the funds. I mean, it's the personal interest that's driving this.
Yeah, I would argue these communists would want to do the exact same thing, actually. But Mark, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if we're setting Russia against the West, clearly completely different models in place. I mean, you know, a lot of malfeasance in the West. And we should also remember that the extent to which actually the West connives at and benefits from all these schemes, yeah, and systems. But... you know, that's not the only game in town. I think if one looks at Central Asia, if one looks at Azerbaijan, parts of the Middle East, I mean, you know...
So we're talking about the former Soviet space plus...
Not just. I mean, I think former Soviet space is one of it. But actually, you know, we've seen similar patterns in parts of Latin America. We've seen it in Asia. We certainly see it in Africa. I think it's just... in the modern world, with the way that the globalization of finance has taken place, with the scope for, in a way, countries and jurisdictions which are all too willing to basically be courtesans and allow these processes to take place, this is what a modern kleptocracy does. You actually take advantage of all these wonderful sort of instruments. You don't have to nowadays just simply take suitcases of cash and stuff them in a vault in Switzerland. Now you can do all these cool extra things that presumably make it harder to trace, harder to prove, and easier to move and use your money. And the rest of the world, the quote-unquote honest bits of the world, happily sort of indulge them and encourage them.
Well, this leads into what I want. One of the things I wanted to talk about, because... you got to wonder what kind of an international reaction there is going to be right now to all of this. I mean, okay, the Western governments are dutifully, whatever, sanctioning those who have been implicated in this. The Icelandic prime minister, whose name I'm not even going to begin to try to pronounce, fell this week. David Cameron's got a big headache on his hands in the UK.
Quite sure, though, what Poroshenko is going to end up facing, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Poroshenko is, but at least he's got a political headache on his hands. But in terms of containing the big kleptocracies, and the big one that was named in this was Russia, you have to wonder if there's going to be some kind of, for lack of a better term, financial containment. You know, during the Cold War, we had something called COCOM, which prevented all sorts of technology transfers to the Soviet Union for things that could be used for military expansion or repression of human rights. And I'm almost wondering if there needs to be some kind of COCOM for financial instruments, so to speak. Or I don't know. I mean, what kind of reactions do you see? Do you see this getting curbed? Because these revelations, like we saw this week in the Panama Papers, are coming fast and furious now. And I don't think they're going to stop. Certainly not if you two have anything to say about it. So you gotta wonder, is there going to be an effort to crack down on this, or is business as usual just going to continue?
Well, this is something I'm writing about a lot. And so I have, there's not a simple answer, but clearly what's required is that when all of this money was in the West, but it wasn't of the West, Western individuals, through lobbies, create tax regimes that have loopholes that people with money and people with lawyers go through, so that you know, America isn't a big player in the Panama Papers, not, as Cliff Gaddy says, because all of this is a Russian operation, but because...
That was a great bit of trolling. I think Clifford was trolling there. I think it was brilliant.
But because they didn't need to go to Panama, they have Delaware. No, I'm quite serious. Difference between Panama Papers and Delaware is that in Panama, Roldugin had to show a copy of his passport. There is the name of Roldugin at the beginning of this trail. In Delaware, we wouldn't know that Roldugin had money there. You do not need to give your name at the moment that you set up an account in Delaware. Anybody can call. You don't even need to go to Delaware. Anyone can call, and within half a day, you can set up an account. So, and it could be called Sandalwood, and you name your nominees, and nobody knows who they are. So why would an American go to Panama? First of all, you'd probably have to speak Spanish, which would be very inconvenient. But in terms of what to do, well, the Western countries and Western jurisdictions, and of course this is not a federal issue, this is a jurisdiction issue in the United States, they need to sort this out. You know, Joe Biden from Delaware needs to bring his political influence to bear to do something about this problem.
But to do what? They need
by law to force all companies to name their beneficial owners. Period. That's all.
That would do it.
It needs to be a law. They should do it.
That would do it. Mark?
Because then if when Sandalwood was set up in BVI, it would, if this law is changed and a registrar is demanded by the British government, which at the end of the day has sovereign control over BVI, if they demand that all companies created within a British jurisdiction list their beneficial owners, then Roald Dugan's name would be on Sandalwood. I doubt that it would have happened the way it happened.
Right.
That's the first thing. The
so transparent.
Is,
so sunlight's the best form of disinfectant here.
COCOM was a rule for a different world. We have globalization now. We want globalization. We want to be able to benefit from the actual money that is in the system, but we have paid too high a price because states, the Western state system, is now being undermined by tax evasion, the rules for which have been written by people who don't care about the Western state system. Hmm. And that includes, by the way, David Cameron's father. This isn't just a statement against the Russians. You know, David Cameron's father and David Cameron this week is being attacked quite rightly because his father didn't pay tax on his offshore accounts for 30 years while David Cameron was benefiting from all that income, which was not taxed, and going to Eton.
Right. But again, this illustrates, I mean, David Cameron wasn't plundering the British state budget.
he wasn't contributing to it either.
And this is the fundamental difference. The other thing that the reason I brought up COCOM, because COCOM was a national security. It was a measure to enhance national security. And I've been harping on the fact that this corruption is now a national security threat.
This
basically allows states like Russia that are hostile to the international order right now to infiltrate it and undermine it from the inside.
True.
Mark, your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I think two things. One is, if we're going to start sort of kind of a COCOM-ish type route, I mean, the key thing is that it can't, I mean, if it's just simply directed towards Russia, then actually what we are saying is that what Putin and Peskov and co. say is right. That this is essentially just simply a weapon against Russia. If it's going to be done, it has to be done across the board to all the kleptocracies, including the ones that we find convenient and friendly. Mm. It's either a weaponization of finance, shall we say?
Right.
Or else
you said that I didn't use that word yet.
You didn't exactly. I'm getting it in preemptively. Or else it's actually a moral and practical and political issue. You know, mm-hmm. If it's the latter, then it's got to be, you know, Chinese and Saudi money as well as Russian
money. And Israeli money.
Sure. All of which is kind of sensitive, which leads me to the second part. Look, the situation, I mean, is it a problem for the West? Well, yes, obviously, because it affects taxes and so forth, and it creates potential vulnerabilities. But Western governments are not poor innocents who have been led astray by naughty lobbyists. The reason why this continues is actually because, look, everyone knew that this happened, not necessarily in full details and such like, but this is nothing new. In some ways, I think the Russian response, which has been, you know, people are opposed to corruption and so forth. But when it comes down to it, they hear this about Putin and, well, yeah, well, what do you expect? This is the way it is. Mm-hmm. In that respect, to be honest, this is, I think, the global attitude. In the West, there's more sound and fury and individuals begin to get a problem, you know, whether you're an Icelandic or British or whoever. But the actual urge from within the political classes and above all the financial and legal classes to do something about this seriously is still not there.
Right.
And I think this is the big challenge. If this is going to come from anywhere, it actually has to come from national electorates, and presumably encouraged and mobilized by media and so forth. And it is therefore going to be an insurrection in that respect. It is going to be something against the status quo, and it's really hard to bring that about. I'd love to see it. I mean, this whole business of beneficial ownership being stated. I mean, obviously, the problem is then there's going to be other countries which depend on or see a market opportunity in not doing so, and well, then how do we respond to that? But I mean, absolutely, that will be a great step forward. But even just that relatively moderate step forward is facing so much resistance and foot dragging and lobbying that unfortunately, I think this is going to be something that is a sort of a storm for a while. And then it passes, and everyone says, whatever happened about the Panama Papers?
No, this is what I wonder. And this is why, referring back to Clifford Gaddy's, what I thought, excellent piece in the Brookings Institute today, which I do think was a bit of trolling, with a purpose, because I think there's an important underlying point here. What's going to happen at the end of the day are things that are going to happen like the Prime Minister of Iceland falls. David Cameron suffers politically. Poroshenko possibly suffers politically. The President of Argentina faces a criminal probe. But the underlying system is not going to fall that's allowing this. And therefore, who benefits here? Well, the Russians at the end of the day benefits and it creates chaos in the West. I don't think this is a Russian plot against the West, as Gaddy suggested. I think tongue in cheek. But I think the result may actually not harm be more harmful in the West than in Russia. Before we move on to the second half, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, and it's kind of hard to avoid: Putin's little reaction yesterday. What do we make of Putin's reaction? And is the Kremlin nervous? Is this an indication that they are getting nervous? Mark, do you have any?
It's as we're going to be talking in the second part about the National Guard. I mean, clearly there are some raw nerves within the Kremlin at the moment. On this issue, I really wish I felt that there was. I really wish that they could see something that I couldn't, and that there was going to be some rising groundswell on corruption, because it is, I think, one of the potential vulnerability points. I'm just not seeing it at the moment. So, as I said, in this respect, I'm hoping that they see something that I don't.
So why didn't Putin just ignore it? He spoke publicly and at length about it, and I would add, quite ridiculously about
well,
it.
Well,
I thought it was
you and I would think it ridiculous. But I think there comes a point, given that, as it were, Peskov had already flagged it up in advance.
Well, that's the other thing. They flagged it before it came out.
Well,
it was a great service to this story.
Yeah,
sure,
what Peskov did,
or maybe it's all part of the Russian information operation that Cliff pointed out. No, I mean, I think, you know, having brought it out there, and given that, you know, clearly it is getting coverage, they started that. Their first line was to ignore it. Their second line was to concentrate on the Camerons and the Poroshenkos and those sort of things, and not mention the Putin dimension. And then I think, you know, that became a little bit less hard to sustain. But I think, look, we shouldn't assume that everything Putin does is phenomenally carefully calibrated. I think he probably was irritated. I mean, because after all, this story, I mean, you know, this story has been spun from the first as the Russia story,
yeah,
when it's not. That is just simply a way in which actually the Western media has chosen to do it. And my God,
well, I think the reason that is because, as I said, it exposed something entirely different about Russia than it exposed about the West.
Well, yeah, but you might say, but in some ways, though, it exposed exactly what we knew about Russia, when in some ways it exposed things we didn't know about the West.
Good point.
So, I mean, like it or not, this was, you know, this is a set of papers, most of which is not about Russia, that nonetheless was presented as a Russia story. And I think that just basically got up some collective noses. Uh-huh. And therefore, I think what we saw was Putin acting out of irritation rather than some carefully programmed media management.
Karen, last word on this subject to you before we move on.
Well, I will say that the funny thing about the Putin response was, you know, if you had a friend as close and as long-standing as Roald Dugin, would you do to that friend what Putin did? which is basically to lay out their closeness, to talk about him as a businessman. In other words, to say that this person has had business and has a share in one of, as he said, our companies.
Right, that was telling language.
It was very telling. And to basically say this is Roald Dugan is one of us, you know? And that's not what somebody who's has been head of the Petersburg Conservatory wants to trumpet. It's not to say that you don't need to be close to power, but to be, you know, the bosom buddy of Putin and to be said to be buying instruments that he has already started to give to the state. I bet that was news to Roald Dugan he's supposed to hand over cellos.
No, I bet that man's not sleeping well right now.
I will say that in following this story, people who have seen the documents have said that Roald Dugan may have been, the evidence suggests that Roald Dugan himself may have been a very unwitting and unwilling partner in this scheme. So that pulling him close and basically saying, you know, man up, you're part of this and we've got your signature, is going to be very, I think, hurtful to him.
It's akin to throwing him under the bus, I would say.
It is, absolutely. And I would say also that one of the things that's very interesting about the Kremlin reaction this week is that they've announced the same thing that the Department of Justice has announced. They're going to be looking at these documents. Some of the Panama Papers will reveal the schemes of those close to Putin, but some of them will also ultimately reveal the schemes of those who've said they're not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin will be very interested in that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting when the other shoe drops on this.
Yeah.
All right, well, in a few moments, we will shift gears and look at a major reshuffle of Russia's security services that resulted in Vladimir Putin getting his own personal army. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Karen Dawisha, director of the Haviger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, The Putin Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Порядок на виду, ход президента оригинальный. Мы служим в армии, теперь национальной.
Well, that is a very funny parody that my producer Tanya found of a parody of a hymn for the new National Guard done to the theme of the Three Musketeers, and we just couldn't resist using that. So there you have it. Well, don't look now, but Vladimir Putin just got his own Praetorian Guard. The Kremlin announced this week that Putin's former bodyguard, Viktor Zolotov, will head up a newly formed National Guard force. The force will absorb current Interior Ministry troops, the Yaman Riot Police, as well as the Sobor or SWAT forces, and it will report directly to Putin. This, of course, was part of a larger shakeup in the security services that saw the Federal Anti-Narcotics Service and the Federal Migration Service dissolved and folded into the Interior Ministry, and the Anti-Narcotics Service chief, old Putin crony Viktor Ivanov, on the verge of being named Deputy Interior Minister. Mark, on your blog, you called this a very big deal. I did you one better. I called it a very big expletive deleted deal. Why is this a big deal? And what does it tell us about the state of things in Siloviki land right now?
It's a big deal not so much for the nature of the force itself, which, after all, is precisely a rebadging and a resubordination of existing public order forces and paramilitaries. It's a big deal because of what this says about the Kremlin's concerns. This is an idea, after all, that has been floated periodically. And each time people have decided, look, actually, it's not really worth it. There isn't the threat to merit the inevitable dislocations and cost of creating a sort of separate National Guard. This time, clearly, from the Kremlin's point of view, it's different. Because after all, this is a force, particularly once you put it under someone like Viktor Zolotov, who is not only tremendously close to Putin, not so much in a man who has his own power base, but precisely as a highly, highly trusted, once bullet catcher, now I suspect bullet unleasher. So you have a person who is personally loyal to Putin, who, according to accounts, has a particularly ruthless approach to how political order should be maintained. Directly subordinated to the Kremlin, so any orders would not have to go through the Interior Ministry. And now who has this force, which courtesy of transferring the riot police and the Sobor, is actually going to be present at a far more sort of lower level of Russian settlements than the Interior Ministry troops. It means that, you know, small towns are going to have a representation of the National Guard. Now, why do you do this? It's not for the reasons that Putin gave. This is not in any way going to help the fight against organized crime or drug trafficking or whatever. If anything, it's actually going to get in the way, because what it does is it disconnects the investigators from the people who would actually carry out the, you know, arrests and so forth of particularly high value and high risk targets. So it actually just creates a whole new bureaucratic hurdle in that respect. No, I mean, this is about creating a political security force, one for control of the streets. And so presumably they're thinking about the Duma elections, that they might well need to do some extensive and blatant rigging to get the results they want, and fearing that that might lead to some kind of Bolotnaya 2.0 or similar. And you need to get your force sort of created now, so it's got a few months to shake down and operate. But the second thing that strikes me is, look, I can't help but feel this is also in some ways directed towards the elite. Mm-hmm. Because precisely this is creating a force which is going to be completely beholden to Putin. And it's not, therefore, because I think we're going to see sort of a clash between army tanks and National Guard tanks in Red Square or anything like that. The very presence of such a force acts as a serious deterrent to any political conspiracies. Because after all, if one thinks of the scenario in which there's a political coup against Putin, one of the key things is basically the security apparatus has to be part of right. that conspiracy. Someone like Zolotov, presumably the thinking is he has nowhere else to go. There, you know, at least he can definitely be counted on. So if anything happens, at least his guys will be able to round up anyone who might want to get rid of Putin. So all this is actually quite worrying things about the thinking that may well be currently happening in the Kremlin.
Now, the other thing that jumped out at me, and you in your initial blog post noted this, that the losers seem to be Viktor Ivanov, because his agency was being dissolved and folded into the Interior Ministry. There were reports yesterday, one in Kommersant in particular, that Ivanov may be now appointed deputy Interior Minister, Zolotov's old job. What about the rivalries within the Siloviki?
Yeah, I mean, I think here it's interesting because it's not just the Interior Ministry. I mean, absolutely, the Interior Ministry loses, not just because it's lost its interior troops.
Kolokoltsev loses big time, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, because the Sobor, the sort of SWAT units, they're very much kind of granular forces that are kind of called on day in, day out to support the regular police. And actually losing them, therefore, is an inconvenience. And frankly, I suspect that the police are going to have to try and find some more way of recreating a new form of Sobor. But perhaps most importantly, part of the reshuffle includes the transfer of FGUP Okhrana, which is the Interior Ministry's private security arm,
right.
whereby they kind of hire out cops to, you know, guard banks and anything else that might
Channel
be.
Channel One, as the case may be.
Yeah, exactly. That makes money. I mean, that actually has been a cost center, a profit center, not just for the Interior Ministry as a whole, but also for a lot of cops, it's worth mentioning. So in this respect, it's actually sort of taking away not just sort of resources in personnel form, but also actually in monetary form. So definitely Kolokoltsev loses, and he loses double in the sense of, I mean, The anti-drug service, the FSKN, isn't being dissolved. It's actually maintained as a separate service, but now subordinated to the ministry.
The ministry, right.
And as a result, Kolokoltsev now has precisely Viktor Ivanov as a subordinate. Viktor Ivanov has made it clear that he's not happy with this. He's already been sort of briefing to this effect. He is a pain in the backside, I would suggest, to have as a potential subordinate, because he's, you know, been ambitious.
Wouldn't he be a subordinate in name only, though?
Well, not really. I mean, I think Viktor Ivanov has no real political base of his own.
Other than Putin.
In some ways, not even frankly Putin, I think. In some ways, he's like Bastrykin. Mm. In the sense of, you know, he is a political entrepreneur who has to keep being in the news and being active and being useful to maintain it. He can't rely on kind of the old boys network. And so, I mean, he is exceedingly nationalistic, hardline. He's very much always pushing the NATO stirred up Afghanistan, so lots of heroin would go into Russia kind of lunacies. Whereas Kolokoltsev is, you know, a technocrat. He's a professional cop. And therefore, I think actually having Ivanov as a subordinate is going to be problematic. But finally, several other services lose. I mean, the Federal Security Service, the FSB, now has in some ways a kind of rival, occupying different operational niches, but the point is they're both involved in basically political security. With the FSKN gone, then that was always one of the sort of counterweights to other agencies. So, I mean, this is definitely destabilizing the old status quo of the security apparatus.
So Putin's got to be really nervous if he was willing to shake up the whole status quo this way, because you're seeing you've named a lot of people here that have lost. The only ones that seem to win are Zolotov and potentially Putin.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, I mean, even just looking at Kolokoltsev at the when it was announced, I mean, he did not look like someone who had been in the loop and was comfortable with what was going on.
Right.
And I think, again, this is in some ways also a reflection of just the way policy is these days, that discussions are taking place within incredibly small circles and then just simply get announced. Right. There's no need to prepare the ground. There's no need to create consensus or anything like that. It's just this is Putin or Putin's circles.
Yeah, no, this came out of the blue. This came out of the remember, I sent it to you and said, what do you make of this? This came out of the blue. Karen, I'm going to get you in here. I mean, this announcement came just days after the Panama Papers hit the web. You know, Safbadania, was this a coincidence?
Well, I doubt that, but there's a couple of things I would say about Zolotov and Kolokoltsev and this whole developing storm, which has been around for a while, the idea that there's going to be some force and Zolotov is going to be the head of it, and will he become Minister of Interior and Kolokoltsev let go and all that. I was very struck when Nemtsov was killed, that Kolokoltsev himself went to the scene and was on television, looking rather shaken. I'm not sure whether he had foreknowledge or whatever, but he certainly was the one who had a big problem on his hands. And Zolotov disappeared from Moscow at the same time that Putin did and was not seen for as long as Putin was not seen. In fact, he was absent from the meeting of the collegium of the Ministry of Interior, which was televised, that Putin went to. Zolotov was not there, unless he was in disguise. I mean, he should have been in the front row. He wasn't in the front row. And the first time we saw Zolotov was an Instagram picture that Kadyrov posted of Zolotov with him, which was captured by people who watch Kadyrov's Instagram, but was quickly taken down. So I think this is a story that's been brewing in the sense that Zolotov seems to be, to me, the point man between Putin and what I would call the irregular forces, the bikers, the Chechens, and although, you know, if it's the Sever battalion that from which came the assassins of Nemtsov, then they can hardly be called irregular forces. They are, after all, ultimately under the in part of the vertical that leads up to the Ministry of Interior. And so we have here a promotion of someone who is regarded by everyone as the most loyal of the loyal to Putin. Now, I would question whether Putin is right in thinking that. I mean, Zolotov was more senior than Putin in KGB when he was sent by Korshakov to become someone who would set up Baltic escort and provide quote-unquote private security.
Right, the private security
Sobchak
force in St. Petersburg, yeah.
For Sobchak and then Putin. He was senior, and he was already someone who had risen to the very top of the Yeltsin group, had, you know, we all know his prehistory. So I think while Putin may regard him as the most loyal of the loyal, how loyal is that at the end of the day? And now you've put Zolotov at the head of a 400,000, they say, person force. Also, Viktor Ivanov must be disappointed in a sense of possibly being slotted under Kolokoltsev. But his star is surely somewhat tarnished by the statements against him in the Litvinenko inquiry, showing that he is both the chief drug enforcer and the chief drug supplier in Russia. So what to do with that situation? I think that all of this shows that Putin has a decreasing number of cards to play. Mm. And I can't imagine that he would be right in thinking that Zolotov is under all circumstances going to be loyal to him.
Well, that's interesting, because I've always looked at Zolotov as like Putin's boogeyman. Whenever when he got something, whether it was going to be the Interior Ministry or something like this, you knew that Putin was going to get serious. He was pulling his boogeyman out of the closet. You're suggesting he has his own agenda, Mark. What do you think?
Well, look, everyone has their own agenda when it comes down to it. And this is Putin's challenge and his problem. Not that I particularly shed any tears for him, is that he's created this system whereby precisely loyalty is something that is constantly bought and earned and demonstrated, but above all negotiated. This is not something. I mean, you know, going back to the whole business with Roldugin, And one can also look at other people like Yakunin or whatever, that this is not a place in which actually, maybe with the exception of sort of a few, the Rotenbergs or whatever, anyone is safe. Anyone can really feel that they can bask in the warm appreciation of the president forever. So in this respect, I mean, you create a system in which precisely everyone is basically out for themselves. And the way you do that is by seeing how you can manipulate and adapt the system. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, I think from this point of view, Zolotov, you might say, is as good as Putin can get. Uh-huh. Not least because I don't think he has that many key friends in Moscow, you know, probably rather more in Grozny. And that's also a great advantage from Putin's point of view.
And he's the one still of you who has good relations with Kadyrov.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but in terms of having someone, you know, this is not someone who has natural allies within the rest of the Silovik constituency. Even even within the old Federal Guard Service, which is, you know, where he was when he was head of the Presidential Security Detail. So in that respect, you know, from Putin's point of view, he's probably the best he can do because he seems pretty loyal, and more to the point, he doesn't have enough serious friends to be potentially you know dangerously disloyal. But when it comes down to it, it's all about what the calculation is on the day, who offers what, and what he thinks is going to be the best option.
Well, to close out our program today, I'll ask you both a question that popped up on my Twitter feed that one of my Twitter followers asked me. Is a Knight of the Long Knives in the offing? Not anytime soon, but anytime. I mean, because this is the picture we're painting here suggests that could be the case. No,
Mark, I think this is deterrence rather than preparation. I mean, from Putin's point of view, frankly, anything like that would be absolutely disastrous. I don't think, if nothing else, he has a kind of a cadre of people on whom he can rely to fill vacancies, because precisely he has shrunk away from the political elite. You know, that's one of the side effects of being in such a small circle. I think the reason for having this kind of a structure is precisely to prevent the need for something like that.
Mm-hmm. Taryn, last word to you.
I would say we've seen one night, and that was Yakunin's fall. Look, Yakunin, to me, represented somebody who was against whom compromise was played, the compromise of his son and grandson in London. But in terms of what Yakunin believes and believed, Yakunin was against this. I mean, he represents someone who could have been a natural leader of a far right coup, and you know, of those who are in the foreign intelligence, who speak the languages, for whom all of this dirty corruption is really beneath them. That's not to say that they aren't engaging in it in terms of in small terms, but I think that was a signal that, you know, this is what will happen. Even Yakunin is replaceable.
Right. So your answer to my question would be yes, then.
Yes, okay. Yes, but I don't think he needs to use knives.
No, they don't use knives anymore.
Evidently, just denying you access to your son and grandson, which has, of course, clearly been done, is enough. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, on that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University and an expert on Russia's security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Ann Arbor, Michigan, has been Karen Dawisha, director of the Habiger Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies at the University of Miami, Ohio, and author of the highly acclaimed book, Putin's Kleptocracy, Who Owns Russia? Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. And you can also follow Pavel's excellent feed on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.